Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And during this live broadcast, we have open telephone lines for you if you want to call in with questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or if you have a difference of opinion from the host and want to bring that up for discussion, feel free to do that. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And you can get right through if you call now because we have some lines open for you at this time. Our first caller today is Travis from Nashville, Tennessee. Travis, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. It's a pleasure to talk to you again today.
Thank you.
My question is about the lectures that you have regarding Israel. And with great interest, I've listened to all four of the lectures you have on your website and some other teachings you have about it. I also went and listened to a debate you had with Dr. Michael Brown about that very topic. And, you know, I find myself very, very much edified by what you're teaching. I really am, if I could say it this way, I'm on your side regarding these matters now. But anyways, one of the questions he seems to pose, and he just recently debated Gary DeMar about this very topic, is he indicates that that if God cursed Israel, then he often says that when God has scattered, nobody can gather. What God has regathered, nobody can scatter. What God has done, nobody can undo. And so he kind of boasts to the idea that if God has scattered Israel in his wrath and his anger, how is it that the Jewish people are able to come back together again in 1948 and become a nation if they were in judgment of doing so? And so, one of the things he points out in his radio program is nobody's been ever able to answer that question for him. And I was wondering what you had to say about that.
Well, first of all, I'd like to know what verses he's referring to when he says what God scatters, no one can gather, and what God gathers, no one can scatter. I don't know of a verse that actually says that, but maybe there's one in there I'm forgetting. But if he had a verse, I'd be interested in seeing it and its context. At this point, I don't believe, I'm not aware of the Bible actually saying that, and I'm not sure why it would be so. I mean, when Jesus said, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, he made it very clear that it is possible, but forbidden, for man to put asunder what God has joined together. So man can undo in some of the effects of what God has done if we're disobedient. We obviously should go along with what God does and be cooperative with his purposes and his providence, but sometimes we're not content to do that. So although, I don't know of anything in the Bible that says that man cannot undo what God does, but it does indicate we shouldn't. So when Jesus said what God has joined together, he means in marriage, let not men put asunder, is, he makes it very clear. It's possible. Men sometimes do, but they're forbidden to. To say don't let anyone do that is to suggest that it's a possibility, or else why would you forbid it if it couldn't even be done? If a mother told her children, I've just spent the morning cleaning up the house, don't mess it up, that's not saying that they're incapable of messing up. It's saying that they'll be doing the wrong thing if they do. She's forbidding it. But she has to forbid it because they are capable of doing it. So I don't really see any issue there. Now, as far as why Israel would come together as a nation in 1948, there's lots of factors that caused it to come to pass. Of course, if a person believed that God prophesied that it would happen, they would see all those factors as part of God's providential moving to bring it to pass. If a person doesn't think that God has prophesied this to happen, then they would see all those factors as just natural factors, which is possible also. So, I mean, the real issue is, does the Bible predict that God's going to do it? And I'm not of the opinion that it does. Now, of course, there are passages in the Bible that say that God was going to scatter Israel all over the place and then regather them from all the places he scattered them. And that happened after the predictions were made. They were scattered to Babylon, and they were brought back from Babylon. And after that happened, there were predictions of scattering, but no more predictions of gathering anymore. Jesus said that they would be scattered again in Luke 21, verses 20 through 23. He said they'd be scattered throughout all nations and slain with a sword and so forth. But he never said they'd come back again. And nowhere in the New Testament does it say they would. So when the Old Testament says God would scatter them and then regather them, he did. He did all that centuries before Jesus was born. But when Jesus came and said they'd be scattered again, there was never any prediction after that that they'd be regathered. So I don't know if, you know, if God didn't say he's going to regather them and they got together through certain circumstances, like, for example, the public sympathy, international sympathy they garnered through the horrible things they suffered in the Holocaust. You know, a lot of people, as a result of the Holocaust, felt that they really ought to support Zionism and help the Jews get back to their own land, because as long as they were scattered throughout pagan lands, Gentile lands, these kinds of things could keep happening, as they had happened throughout history. So, you know, international sympathy was very much in favor of establishing the state of Israel. But even before that happened, dispensational writers and preachers were petitioning American presidents from the beginning of the 20th century. Every president received a long petition from dispensational pastors saying, we support and we urge you to support the reestablishment of the nation of Israel. And eventually, lots of presidents pretty much ignored that, but eventually, you know, especially after World War II and information about the Holocaust came out, you know, there was so much general sympathy for the Jews in this matter that this petition was respected. And of course, Zionism began in the 1800s in England, but it didn't really take off to the point where Israel was recognized as a nation again until after World War II. And very largely through the influence of American Christians. And you can actually read secular histories of the nation of Israel written by Jewish, not Christian, writers that acknowledge that the dispensational Christians in America had a big role to play in the reestablishment of the nation of Israel. So one could argue, well, God used dispensational Christians to bring about what he said he was going to do. Or one could argue that it happened because dispensational Christians believed it should, and they made it happen, or at least they and other factors made it happen. But, you know, I would have to, if I was talking to Michael Brown about that point, I have to ask him, okay, where in the Bible does it say that man cannot undo what God has done?
I'm not sure if it's Jeremiah. I wish I had the scripture. I'm just driving in my car, so I didn't apologize. I didn't look it up before I called you. But I think it, in particular, that scripture he's referencing says something along the lines of any door that he shuts, nobody can open. Whatever he opens, no one can shut. And then he goes on to talk about what I said before about
that,
gathering and regathering. And
that,
so
that business about shutting and opening is found in Isaiah chapter 22 in a prophecy about Eliakim. And it is quoted by Jesus in Revelation chapter 3 about himself. He says, I'm the one who opens and no man shuts, and I shut and no man opens. But that's not talking about geopolitics. That's talking about acceptance in the sight of God of people. In this particular case, when Jesus quotes it to the Church of Philadelphia, I think it's because there were people, Jewish people actually, in Philadelphia, who were, you know, saying that the Christians were not God's people. I think the Christians were persecuted there by them. And Jesus assured the church, well, I'm the one who opens those doors and closes them, not them. Yeah. In other words, you know, no man can keep you from heaven or from God's good graces. If God opens the door for you, no man can shut that. On the other hand, if God shuts that door from someone, no one can open it. But that's not talking about politics and national, you know, developments and so forth in the Middle East. That's talking about salvation, really.
Okay. Well, I wish one day you guys would go back and debate that a little longer. I know that,
you know, when I had that
45 minutes or so, it didn't do it justice. I know you had a lot more to say.
I know. When I talked to Michael Brown that time, we had a real good time, but we had to go so quickly and it was so short a time. I just thought it was unfortunate. It was unfortunate because he and I probably could profitably dialogue for a much longer period of time than that on the subject.
I think it'd do the body of Christ really a lot of good to hear a perspective from somebody like you. When he talks to Gary DeMar or even Don Preston just recently, they come with such a different viewpoint than so many people. Real fruit could probably come from a debate from you two, because you're so respectful of one another. You can really share stuff. So I wish your folks would get together and do one for us all.
Well, I really like Dr. Michael Brown a lot, and I'd love to have a longer conversation with him. But I don't organize those things. Other people do, you know. So if someone organizes it, I'll be there.
Well, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
All right. Appreciate your call, Travis. God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye now. Okay. We're going to talk next to Kent from Seattle, Washington. Kent, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm calling in reference to John Calvin. And I've been, you know, I've read a lot. I've listened to you a lot on him and everything. And I've talked to some of my Calvin friends, and I said something to one of them. I think I probably rubbed him the wrong way. And I said, I honestly question even John Calvin's salvation. And I'm coming from the area of that when I think of the Apostle Paul and the message that he got of grace, you know, when he was so much into legalism of the law and everything, and he was so set free that when the message of grace came, is that he stopped persecuting Christians, and as a matter of fact, he allowed himself to be persecuted and putting people in prison. He allowed himself to be in prison, and you know, grace completely changed who he was. And if it's true, and what I've read in a lot of things of the history of John Calvin and the Calvinists is with their persecution of the Anabaptists and you know, and things like that, I just think that if you really do get the message of grace like Paul did, it changes your life from those things. It causes you to have a love and a grace for others. Them that, you know, Paul never turned around and started persecuting the Jews after he received the message of grace because they didn't believe it the same way he did. But I just wonder, really, did he really get the message? You know,
yeah,
really
you wonder. You got to wonder. Now, we do have to remember that both Martin Luther and John Calvin were Roman Catholic priests.
Right.
Well, Luther was a Catholic monk and Calvin was a Catholic priest before they became Protestants. And they were among they were among the first persons to become Protestants, which meant they had an awful lot of Roman Catholic, what should we say, mentality still in them. And the Roman Catholic Church for 1,000 years at that time had been persecuting everyone that they called a heretic. Because they felt that they felt like heretics were leading people to hell, and therefore to kill a heretic, to burn him. I mean, it was Augustine who first argued very strongly that heretics should be burned and persecuted and so forth. It was Augustine was responsible for that doctrine, and and the Roman Catholics picked it up, and of course Luther and Calvin were both Augustinians, and they were both Roman Catholics, so. So they had that mentality, which had been, you know, ingrained for 1,000 years in the mentality of the false church. Now, that doesn't make it okay. That doesn't make it okay. You know, Calvin, when he had Michael Servetus burned as he did, Calvin was in no sense acting in the spirit of Christ. When he wrote diatribes against the Anabaptists, he was not operating in the spirit of Christ. Luther, when he wrote that the peasants and the peasant rebellion should have their heads crushed and that the Jews should have their synagogues burned down, Luther was not operating in the spirit of Christ at that time. On the other hand, and I don't mean this to justify them, I have to say that, you know, there are times when all of us seem to not operate in the spirit of Christ, even those of us who really do love the Lord. And when we catch people doing really, really inconsistent things, and Calvin and Luther both did things that are very inconsistent for a Christian to do, we have to ask ourselves, you know, is this inconsistency an evidence that the man is not a Christian, or is it an evidence that he's got some huge blind spots and he's really doing damage to the cause of Christ because of his blind spots, but he really does love the Lord? Now, I don't know the answer to that in those two men's cases. They lived too long ago. It is possible that both of them were just intellectual Christians. I mean, let's face it.
That's what I feel. Yeah.
I mean, they were both very intellectual, and they were both embroiled in theological controversies. And when you're embroiled in theological controversies, and the church for 1,000 years has been judging people by their intellectual beliefs, it's very possible for them to feel like they've radically changed from the Roman Catholic Church because they've radically changed some of their views. But they may not have exchanged spirits. They may have the same spirit that the persecuting Roman Catholics had. So, I mean, I'm going to have to leave that to God's judgment. I don't know to what degree, I don't know to what degree they really loved the Lord, or to what degree they were just intellectually, you know, seeing things more clearly than the Roman Catholics had seen them. But so I can't be their judge, but I will agree with you that their murderous behavior and their hatred for persons who are not of the same view as themselves was certainly inconsistent with Christianity.
Right. I agree, you know, with what you're saying. I mean, it makes me think, you know, second thoughts. But the thing is still is I still believe though that Paul was ingrained at that time, even within the Jewish nation for all them years also. But when Paul did get that gospel of grace, he still stopped.
You're right. You're right. I mean,
I just think that there's more of a revelation to the grace of God than, like you said, intellectually. And I kind of hold more, probably less to Luther, I think, because I think he was a pastor, and I think he had a little bit different of a heart. But I don't get it. Honestly, to be really honest with you, I have a lot of friends that are Calvinists, and they don't lash out, and we can have, you know, we can talk, you know what I mean, and everything. It's really wonderful.
Yeah.
But it seems like a lot of the division, even within the church today, may not be, you know, that we're killing each other, you know, by drowning or by beheading each other, but verbally. You know, we're killing one another. And it seems like the biggest one that's causing the biggest havoc within the church today is the Calvinists, even towards people, I think, that are, strong, you know, consistent believers, like even, you know, Calvary Chapel. I've heard them attacked and stuff like that. I don't agree with everything at Calvary Chapel, but I do believe, they brought a lot of people to Christ. And it seems like that now that's even being questioned by a lot of the head Calvinists today. And I just don't. It just
I know.
Seems
like John MacArthur.
Different. There's something that just isn't, well, not just him. I mean, the arrogancy, that's one thing. You know, I mean, you know, most Calvinists I talk to say, as a matter of fact, I was in a room full of them, and we were talking, and they said, what's the number one attribute you think a person should have, you know, that of the essence of God? And all of them said knowledge, and I said, I disagree with that. I said, the wisdom and the love of God are far surpassed.
Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies.
That's it. That's what I'm saying, right.
And that is what, you know, when you said that the people who are causing the most divisions in the body of Christ are the Calvinists, I'm not sure that I could say that's true, but I would say that many Calvinists do seem to be very intent on dividing the body of Christ over the Calvinistic issues. There definitely are some mean-spirited people out there who call themselves Christians, and a lot of them are attracted to the Calvinist doctrine. Now, I say it that way because there's some very tender-hearted, loving, godly, spiritual people who believe the Calvinist doctrines too.
So we can't
broad brush all Calvinists.
Right.
But I would have to say my experience is similar to yours, and that the people who really want to get into a fight over non-essentials often are the people who want to fight over Calvinism.
Can I ask one other question? I can move on if you want. That's fine.
No, go ahead.
The other day you were talking to a gentleman about his brother, his brother's wife, that was about divorce and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so do you believe then, me and a friend of mine was talking about it, we were just wondering, so do you believe then even if a person who, you know, he wasn't, you know, let's say they moved on, that, you know, they were married to someone else after 15 years and they had children with another person, do you think if the other person came back to him, they still have the obligation of going back to their wife?
That's a very nuanced situation. I believe that if a person has left a faithful spouse, and that spouse that they left has remained faithful, then no matter what the unfaithful partner has done, they owe it to the faithful partner to come back. Now, and that includes if they've entered an adulterous marriage, had illegitimate children in an adulterous marriage. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, it's very cruel to ask these people to leave their second spouse and their children. Well, wasn't it cruel for them to leave their first spouse and their real children? You know, I mean, I mean, it's a sad thing. It's a sad thing that they spawn children in an adulterous relationship, which of course raises questions about the children's legitimacy. Not that children, there's no illegitimate children. There's just illegitimate parents. But the point is, these are children who are really born out of wedlock. Even though a marriage license was issued, if the relationship is one that Jesus defined as adultery, it's not what Jesus defines as marriage. And therefore, all the children of that relationship were born out of wedlock. Now, often the person in question has legitimate children from his first wife or from her first husband. And, you know, I don't understand why some people think, oh, it's so cruel to ask them to leave the second marriage and the children of that second relationship in order to go back to their first marriage and their first relationship. And the only reason that would seem cruel is because we're more sympathetic to the perpetrator than to the victim. Because the faithful spouse.
I've been the victim of that before.
Yeah. Yeah, the faithful spouse that's been abandoned is the victim. The person who left them is a perpetrator. They are a criminal, basically. They're a perjurer. They made vows in the sight of God and broke their vows. That's perjury. And so the faithful spouse is a victim of perjury. And the perjurer somehow gets all the sympathy. Once that perjurer goes on and enters an adulterous relationship and calls it a marriage and has a new family, somehow all sympathies apparently are with the perjurer, and the perjurer's victim and children, they just are, left out in the cold as far as many Christians are concerned. And I think Christians need to start thinking biblically about it too. See, the problem is that back in the 1960s, our culture adopted the no-fault divorce idea. Christians knew better, but the pagans didn't. And so divorcing for no reason at all became very commonplace. And now, 50 years later or so, it's obvious that the church has lost sight of what marriage is and what divorce is and things like that. Now, of course, some people say that now that the courts have ruled that same-sex marriage is normal, that the churches can still keep their own standards, and certainly they can if they will. But they didn't. They didn't with the no-fault divorce issue. I mean, the church left their standards to go along with the pagan standards very shortly after the courts decided that way. And now that the courts have decided their way, it's very unlikely that very many churches will keep a vigorous, standard of marriage. Because churches are about ready to give up their prophetic voice to society on this matter of marriage as soon as the laws don't agree with them anymore. And that's just
heard a pastor say something. He says, "Why do I think of the problem with same-sex marriage?" He goes, "There's no problem with it. God already says what he thinks of it." He says that I have more of a problem right now with just the marriages within the church.
Well, yeah, we don't have to worry about same-sex marriage because there is no such thing.
He's saying there's no such thing. The problems of marriage in the church today and marriage and divorce today.
Yeah, just like a man who leaves his wife for no good reason marries another woman. He has what the world calls a marriage, but what God calls it is adultery. That's not a marriage. That's adultery. Likewise, if two people of same sex get married, well, that's not a marriage either. They can call it that. People can call it anything they want to call it, but that's not a marriage. There's no such thing as same-sex marriage because marriage is what God said it is. It's not something else. And as soon as a person wants to marry their dog and call that a marriage, they can call it that if they want to, but that's not going to change anything. Marriage isn't between a man and a dog. It's not between a man and a man, a woman and a woman, a man and three women, or a woman and three men, a man and his daughter, or a man and his mother. Those aren't marriage. Those are incest, and those are other, and bestiality. I mean, there are names for those things, and marriage is not the name for it.
Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate your work.
Okay, Kent. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We have one line open for you, and that's at 844-484-5737. All right, we're going to talk next to John from Watsonville. Hi, John. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. This could be a pretty short call. I just want to ask, have you read the book Rees Howell's Intercessor?
Yes, I read it back in the 70s, Rees Howell's Intercessor.
Yeah, it is just so incredible, some of the stuff that happens that God blesses him with and the answer that God gives him.
He was an amazing man, yes, yes.
I just thought, can this be real? You know, I'd like to talk to some of the Christians. I'd like to talk to Steve Gregg and see what he thinks of it.
Well, the book was written by Norman Grubb, who I think he knew Rees Howells. I think they were personally acquainted. And if I'm not mistaken, Norman Grubb was married to the daughter of C.T. Studd, whose biography he also wrote. C.T. Studd, famous missionary. I would assume that it comes pretty much from the horse's mouth and from contemporary things. The prayer meetings that Rees Howells was involved in at the Bible College of Wales during World War II and World War III were just astonishing. How it would appear that their prayers in many cases turned the tide in certain battles and so forth, just by their concentrating on praying as a group for those things. It's a remarkable book. Now, the man was controversial in his day. There were famous Christians who disagreed with him on certain emphases and things like that. I mean, certainly the book is written by somebody who admires him, and therefore he is certainly heroic in the book. And I really admire the man. He did great things. But he was not all, you know, he was not uncontroversial, even among the evangelical world. But I still think it's definitely worthwhile and challenging to read about him.
Yeah, it says at one point that the two books that, at least at one point in his life, the two books he was the most attracted to were the Bible and the Autobiography of George Mueller.
Yes, he's one of the many who was affected by George Mueller's testimony. Hudson Taylor was another. There were lots of very important men who were inspired by George Mueller to live by faith in the way that Mueller did. More recently, I've been influenced by him for the past 40 years, 45 years to do so, yeah.
Is that the best book about him, the Autobiography of George Mueller?
I'm not sure if that's the best one. I mean, it's great to hear it from the horse's mouth, but there are other people who knew Mueller who have written biographies of him. You know, if you just go on christianbook.com and look up George Mueller, and you'll find a great quite a number of biographies. Some of the older ones that are written in the 1800s are written in kind of old style. I kind of like the old style of writing, but a modern reader might prefer to get a newer biography. There's probably, I'd be surprised if there's not 6 or 7 biographies of George Mueller out there in print right now.
Right. Yeah, okay. Well, these guys, the things God did was just amazing. And there's no way that the biblical God is not God, if that's true. And I think it's true, you know. I think
that George Mueller, you know, George Mueller in his living by faith was influenced by an earlier man who was his brother-in-law, Anthony Norris Groves. Now, Anthony Norris Groves is a much lesser-known man, although there's a very thick biography recently come out on Anthony Norris Groves, and he influenced George Mueller, who was George Mueller married Anthony Norris Groves' sister, Mary Groves. But Anthony Norris Groves was a British medical doctor, a dentist, and he sold his practice and went to Asia as a missionary, and he lived entirely by faith. He wouldn't tell anyone his needs, and he was just totally trusting God for all his finances. And he wrote, you know, a book called Christian Devotedness, which influenced hundreds of people, maybe thousands. And George Mueller was influenced, and then George Mueller himself became influential on people like Hudson Taylor and Rhys Howells and others. But, I mean, there's a lot of people, Watchman Nee, Brother Andrew, lots of very famous people were influenced by George Mueller and or Anthony Norris Groves. Though Groves is not very well known, he really is the true father of the faith movement, living by faith movement kind of thing that George Mueller is more famous for. There is, as I say, a biography out now, a very thick one, on Anthony Norris Groves, which is I've read most of it, but it's pretty thick. There's a lot of biographies of Mueller. As far as I know, there's only one biography of Rhys Howells, and that's the one by Norman Grubb.
Yeah, I just think that biographies of famous Christians can be just really inspirational.
Well, that's it. When you read the biography of a famous Christian, there's usually a reason they're famous. It's usually because they accomplished a great deal. They were very close to God. They had powerful prayers. They accomplished a great, and it's like being in fellowship with them. You know, it's not always easy today to find people in fellowship, that is face-to-face, real life fellowship, that inspire you to be a great follower of Christ, to lay down your life and be a disciple. It's pretty rare, as a matter of fact, to find Christians today who inspire you that way. And so reading biographies, it's like fellowshipping with them because they are still our brothers. They've gone on to heaven now, but they're still part of the church. And there's a sense in which you fellowship with them. It's kind of a one-way fellowship because they don't know you're there, but you know they're there. It's sort of like when people say they know me because they listen to the radio show, but I don't know them, you know. But sometimes you can feel like you know somebody if you've followed their life enough. And that's how I feel about George Mueller and a number of people. They've been very influential in my life.
Yeah, well, I kind of really enjoy these books. My daughter recently became more of an on-fire Christian down at UCLA with this Grace, John MacArthur's Grace on Campus Fellowship there, and they recommended to her the book you've talked about by A.W. Tozer, Knowing God, I think.
The Pursuit of God.
Well, yeah. G.I. Packer wrote Knowing God, yeah.
Yes, Packer wrote that.
Yeah, I just can't imagine that those books would be good as good as biographies. Are they?
They're good. They're good books.
I mean,
yeah, they're good books. I mean, biographies are great if they're great. I mean, some people write better biographies than others do. But, I mean, the biographies of great men, every Christian should read several, probably several per year. Because otherwise, you know, you're influenced by the spiritual climate around you. And if you're going to a church full of people who are more or less lukewarm or whose salvation is even questionable, then it's kind of good to fellowship with people like Hudson Taylor and George Mueller and Reese Howells and others, you know, Corrie Ten Boom and Richard Wurmbrandt and people like that. Because when you read their biographies, it's like they are influencing you. And if you don't read their biographies, then the Christians around you influence you. And if the Christians around you are lukewarm, they will influence you toward lukewarmness.
Right. But,
yeah. You know, so I think Christians should regularly read biographies of real Christians who really lived for God and who really kind of remind us of what it's really like to be a genuine follower of Christ. Because the modern Christians around us, including the pastors, often don't really do that for us.
There are some books that have a lot of Christian biographies that have short biographies, a whole, like an anthology of them. A guy named Orlando Boyer wrote two volumes of biographies of great Christians, and it's just that's the only biography I've read of George Mueller, the one in there that's like 14.
There's a really old book. And I think the guy who wrote it, I think his name was Lawton or something like that. I forget, but it's called Deeper Experiences of Famous Christians. And if you can't get it in print today, you can get it probably used through Amazon. But it's called Deeper Experiences of Famous Christians. It was written about 100 years ago, I think. And it contains the biographies of, you know, a ton of people. Shortish, but inspiring. You know, you've got D.L. Moody, you've got Finney, you've got Mueller, you've got Hudson Taylor, you've got Savonarola, you've got Wesley, you've got all these great guys, short biographies of them. And it's called Deeper Experiences of Famous Christians. I think it's probably good, I don't know, probably 20 or 30 different biographies in it, and that's a great collection too. But I need to move on along here, but I can't say strongly enough how valuable I think it is to read Christian biographies.
Could you say the name of that book by Lawton once more?
Deeper Experiences of Famous Christians.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.
All right, John. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Now, that wasn't a short call, was it? You thought it might be short. Okay, we're going to talk next to Bob from Hillsboro, Oregon. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I have a question about a denomination that just goes by the Christian Church. I wonder if you're familiar with that.
I think the Christian Church might be the same denomination that used to be called the Disciples of Christ.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could give some insights into maybe their distinctives and kind of particularly towards their views on baptism.
Well, I'm a little fuzzy on this. I think I've heard their history before, but I might be confusing them with something else. I think they might have been a branch off of the Church of Christ. If you go back far enough, I'm not positive.
They said that they came out of the Restoration Movement.
Yeah, the Church of Christ is from the Restoration Movement of the 1800s. And I think the Disciples of Christ, or the Christian Church, as they call themselves now, came out of that. However, I've never encountered a congregation or a pastor of the Christian Church who wasn't a liberal. So I think the denomination went more liberal. I think the Church of Christ, which was once part of them, or vice versa, the Church of Christ is more conservative. And I think the Christian Church is more liberal. Now, I don't want to malign them. If I'm wrong, someone from that denomination can call and tell me so. But that's been my experience. I remember the first time I talked to a pastor from that denomination, you know, he didn't believe that, you know, the story of the Old Testament stories were true and things like that. You know, and that's usually a position that liberalism would take. So I disagreed with him. And then I had very limited experience with that group. That is anyone in that group, and subsequently, and from what I've gotten the impression, I think it's more liberal than the Church of Christ. So I would have more in common, I think, with the Church of Christ than with the Disciples of Christ denomination, or Christian Church, as they call themselves.
Well, kind of in particular, what I was concerned about was their views on baptism and the people I've been talking to, I wouldn't put them as being liberal. So I think they have a conservative Christian view, but okay. They seem to have a view of baptism that it is not just a sign of salvation, but it is part of salvation.
Yeah, the Church of Christ would also agree with that, and I think the Restoration Movement in general had that strong emphasis that baptism was a part of salvation. And there are many in that movement who have taken the position that if you're not baptized, you can't be saved.
Yes,
and this would even include deathbed conversions. You know, if you experience a deathbed conversion and aren't baptized, that you're still not saved. Now, not all take quite that hard a line. I have a friend I've been in correspondence with for many years, who's not Church of Christ, but he's in another church of that type from the Restoration Movement, pretty strong on the baptism thing. But he would suggest that there are, you know, some exceptions where a person might be saved because they couldn't be baptized. I have a dear friend in Riverside near where I live who's from a Church of Christ background, very strong on baptism, but he also would argue that, you know, there would be some circumstances where a person could be saved without being baptized. But some Church of Christ people have taken a very strong stand that you cannot be saved unless you're baptized.
Well, this seemed also to be that, you know, it had to be baptism by immersion, for one, and also that if you weren't aware or acknowledging that it was part of salvation, that baptism alone wasn't enough. You had to understand that baptism was accomplishing your salvation. I mean,
I would disagree with them on that. Where does it say that specific thing? Where does it say in the Bible?
Well, that's why I was calling to see.
Yeah, where does it say in the Bible that when you are baptized, you have to understand that that is accomplishing your salvation? I don't know of anything in the Bible that makes that a requirement. And see the difference between me and some of these people. I believe baptism is extremely I believe it's mandatory. I believe that we're commanded to be baptized and should be baptized. And I don't think there's really very many good reasons why a person would not be baptized if they're saved. Though, like I said, a deathbed repentance might prevent it. Or a person who's truly gotten saved, but no one has told them properly about the need to be baptized. And so they neglect it, not out of rebellion, but because they've never been told about it. That would perhaps be another example of someone who might be able to be saved without being baptized. But baptism is commanded. And anything that's commanded is not optional. But the question is, how legalistic is God? You know, is he going to send people to hell because they didn't get wet properly? Or is he going to send people to hell because their hearts are in rebellion against him? You know, I believe that if a person is properly evangelized and instructed, and they truly come to Christ, they will be baptized because they'll be told that this is what he requires. And as true converts, they'll be determined to do what God requires. So they will be baptized. But again, if they haven't been told that that's necessary, or if they get saved in a situation where there's absolutely no opportunity to be baptized before they die, then how legalistic really is God about it? I don't think God's legalistic at all. Well, and that's where they would differ from me.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what I was looking for, just information and insight into that.
So,
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, Bob. Thanks for your call. Good talking to you. Tom from Everett, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's good to talk every now and then. Hey, in respect to some previous callers, I hear this a lot. People call a lot about divorce issues, and I would just submit that that probably, I can't give you a percentage, but a percentage of divorces probably fail because the two people should have never got married in the first place. They weren't really compatible. They were governed more by hormones than emotions rather than logic. And that's why the divorce probably failed. I think that's true with non-believers as well. But I've been divorced, and I can look back in retrospect and realize that it was a bad decision from the start, but I was too stupid to realize it. And I think a lot of marriages today, that happens. People just sort of grow out of each other because they realize that for whatever reasons they come up with, if they'd listened to somebody wiser, they probably would have never got married in the first place. So I would submit that as one reason why some Christian marriages fail, because they probably should have never got married in the first place.
And well, I want...
If I could just say one more thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that in reference to a previous caller, I'm not sure if it was today or yesterday, but they were talking about God using Christians or something. I personally believe, and I think there's some evidence to support this, that God uses believers and non-believers alike for his purposes. I think sometimes Christians put a limitation on what God can do. He can do anything he wants. And to get something done, he'll do what needs to be done. I think this notion that you have to be super spiritual to be used by God is not really true. I think you just have to be a conduit. Your heart should be right, but at the same time, you know, God uses people in all kinds of situations, even sometimes when they're not even aware of it. He's using them to accomplish his purposes. And I think
is that referring to something that was brought up on this program?
I can't remember. I turned on your program today about 20 minutes into the program. But I've heard these things asked before, and I just wanted to voice an opinion. So I can't honestly say that I heard a previous conversation today, but I thought I caught the end of something referring to something like that. Hmm. But it caught my attention, and that's why I decided to call. But I was going to say in closing, I'll let you take over, that I've really come to realize over the years, and we have similar backgrounds. I won't mention the churches we've attended, but we have some similar connections there. And I've really seen how God, you just can't limit him in what he does, and he's on the throne. And he's got, and even though things look chaotic, he's doing things sometimes openly and sometimes behind the curtain that are accomplishing his ultimate purposes. And for me, at least, I've given up saying, okay, God, should I do this? Should I do that? I just go about my business and trust him that in whatever I'm doing, that's my ministry. And if he wants me to be the next Billy Graham, it'll happen. You know, I don't have to go worrying about it, but just trust him to know that for now, that's all I have to do. And it really is a freeing kind of experience. But once again, and I'll get off the phone here, I just don't limit him. I think God uses people. And I might also add just briefly, if you look at some of the great religious people of the Bible, most of them never wanted to be used. They didn't really want to be used by God. They resisted it. And they were caught by surprise when God called them, because some of them had questionable lifestyles. So I thought that's kind of fascinating as well. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say, and I will get off the phone. All right. Have a good afternoon, and God bless.
Okay, Tom, thank you. Yeah, I don't know what you'd be responding to on this program when you say that you think that God can use non-Christians as well as Christians, because I certainly agree with that. I mean, God used Cyrus. God used Judas. God used Caiaphas and Pilate. And, you know, I mean, so the Bible makes it very clear that God uses unbelievers as well as believers. So I'm not really sure who would have denied that or who would have given a different impression here. And I don't remember a conversation on the show that would have come up as a controversial point. Now, I'm interested in your statement that many divorces take place because people should never have gotten married in the first place. The thing is, how can we know that they shouldn't have gotten married in the first place? We can certainly say that they didn't think it through very well, or that it doesn't seem to have been a wise decision. But you see, everybody who becomes unhappy in their marriage might well tell himself, you know, we should never have gotten married in the first place, because they assume that if we had married the person we should have married, we'd be blissfully happy, and we're not blissfully happy. And since this marriage is requiring hard work and faithfulness to our vows and suffering and trials and so forth and hardship, this probably should have never happened in the first place. Well, I don't know how one would decide that, because most marriages have trials and most marriages have hardships and seasons of testing and so forth. And, I don't deny that there probably are people who never should have gotten married. David and Bathsheba never should have gotten married, but God resolved it. I mean, God used it. I don't know that it's really very useful to make the observation someone should not have gotten married. The truth is, if you're saying that about someone, they did get married. And you wouldn't say they shouldn't have if they hadn't done it. And when someone did get married, it's now the question of, now what should they do? When they were single, it could be argued that they should or should not marry such and such a person. Now that they're married, they've made an oath. They've made a promise. And what should a person do when they made a promise? They should keep the promise. You know, it's like a person who foolishly goes out and buys a Maserati and binds himself for 5 years to make payments for $1,000 a month. And as soon as he gets the car home, within a week or so, he says, you know, I should have never bought this car. Probably shouldn't have. That was probably a stupid thing to do. But what are you supposed to do now? Pay for it. You agreed to it. You promised it. You've signed the paper. You owe. Therefore, you do. You pay the price. And that's a very good reason not to buy a Maserati or not to do anything, not to commit yourself to anything that you haven't thought through very well. And there are people who make those kinds of decisions, including the decision to marry, without thinking things through very well. And that's always sad, because in many cases that'll bring unnecessary difficulties. But so what? Once you've said you're going to be in, you're in, especially when it comes to marriage. I mean, at least with the Maserati, you might find another buyer and sell it to them and pay it off that way. But you can't find another buyer for your wife or your husband that you married. And therefore, you should be careful about who you marry. That's why the Bible is very clear that you don't want to be unequally yoked, don't want to marry somebody who's not a believer. And even if you do marry someone who's a believer, that doesn't mean they're going to be real compatible with you. But what happens if you find you've married someone who's not entirely compatible with you? Well, you're about average then. Most people who get married find out there are things about their spouse that they didn't know about, which they wish were different. Things that their spouse isn't quite so perfect as they thought they were. That there's going to be a little more hardship in this marriage than they dreamed when they were dreaming of marrying that person. If you find that, you know, the marriage is going to be harder than you thought because you're not as compatible as you thought with somebody that you married, then, like, say you're about average. Most people are in that situation. Some people are blessed to have trouble-free marriages. My parents seem to be one of those couples. I'm in a marriage like that right now, and seems very trouble-free, and I'm very fortunate this time. But I certainly know what it's like to be in a marriage that isn't well-matched. But what happens when you find yourself in a marriage where you're not well-matched? You please God by your loving your wife, by you loving your husband, by you being faithful to your vows, and by recognizing that now that you've made a foolish decision, if it was a foolish decision, your assignment is clear. You've got to please God in a situation that may multiply trials in your life. But then trials are not unusual. Trials are what life is often characterized by. Not everybody has equally great trials in their marriage, but those who don't have them in their marriage will have them in some other area. Trials are just a part of life. Man was born to trouble, as surely as sparks fly upward, Job said. So if you're in a troubled marriage, well, that defines what trouble you're going to have to overcome. But you overcome it not by abandoning your vows. You overcome it by becoming more compatible. Now, if your spouse isn't willing to become more compatible, then you may never be able to save the marriage, and they may abandon it. But you shouldn't. If you find you've married someone foolishly and you weren't that compatible, your task is to become as compatible as you can be with them. And your spouse's task is to become as compatible as they can be with you. If they don't do it, it may not work out. But you need to not be the one who doesn't make it work out. You need to do all you can to be the perfect husband or the perfect wife for the person you married. For God's sake, because you're living your life for God. And God wants you to be as perfect a husband or wife as you can be for the person that you're with. If your spouse is not reciprocating, not putting out the same effort, well, then it's going to be hardship for you. But hardship isn't always that bad. Hardship can make you a better person. It can certainly test your mettle. It can teach you lessons of faithfulness. And therefore, you know, so it, maybe even if it's true that a lot of people have married people they shouldn't have married in the first place, I don't really think that's very relevant to the question of why their marriage fails. People fail in their marriages because one or both give up and decide to break their vows. That is, they decide to compromise their integrity and say, I don't care if I lied. I don't care if I perjured myself. I want out, and therefore I'm getting out. And that is why marriages fail. They don't fail because of trouble. And I know that because I was in a marriage full of trouble. And it lasted for 20 years. And it would have lasted to this day if the other party had stayed. And it would last for a lifetime. And many people stay married for a lifetime in marriages that are full of difficulty. So it's not difficulties that destroy marriages. It's unfaithfulness. The only thing that can destroy marriage is unfaithfulness. And every Christian needs to make sure that they're not the one that becomes guilty of that unfaithfulness. The partner might. You can't control your partner, but you should not be unfaithful. John from Albany, Oregon, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I had a question earlier. You were talking to a caller about the issue of remarrying after a divorce and then maybe a subsequent marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I know oftentimes verses aren't exactly specified as we might like them to be in or answering a question, but I think Deuteronomy 24:1-4 at least may state a principle that after a remarriage from a previous divorce and then a spouse remarrying, that maybe we should not try to go back and have another divorce to get back with an initial spouse.
Well, you know, I understand people sometimes see Deuteronomy 24 that way, but that's not exactly what it's saying. It's saying that if a man puts his wife away, so he divorces her, and she goes and marries another, and then she ends up single again because her second husband divorces her or dies, she can't go back to her first husband. And this is not because she sought a second divorce. She didn't. Her husband divorced her. The second husband did. It's the going back to the first husband that's forbidden. It's not the divorce in the second case that's forbidden. It's the fact that that man who put his wife away is not, you know, he's not able to take her back if she's gone to be with another man in the meantime. Now, what about the man who doesn't put her away? What about the man whose wife leaves him? He didn't want her to leave. He didn't divorce her. She marries somebody else, so she's living in adultery, according to Jesus Christ's teaching on this. She's living in adultery, and she's got a husband from her first marriage who's a faithful man. This doesn't fall into the category of Deuteronomy 24 at all, because the man in 24 of Deuteronomy put his wife away and then wanted to take her back. That's what's forbidden. But in the case of a man who's been abandoned by his wife, if she's living in adultery, that would not really come under the teaching of Deuteronomy 24 at all. She's living in adultery, whether she's, you know, whether the adulterous relationship is called a marriage or not. Anyway, I don't say these things to put anyone under condemnation, but I do think the Bible teaches fairly plainly about this stuff. And I appreciate your calls about that. And I know that it puts some people under stress. I'm very sorry that that's true. But I do have an article on divorce and marriage at our website. You can read very comprehensive of the biblical teaching at thenarrowpath.com. Under the topical articles, there's one on divorce and remarriage, thenarrowpath.com. We are listener supported. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can go to thenarrowpath.com, find out how to keep us on the air. There's a donation link. You can even find the address there if you want to send us a check. Thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.